Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us. Well, it is getting close to back to school time. So today, I'll look at teachers, in particular, teacher turnover, and what that can do to a student's academic achievement. Teachers leaving the profession costs the nation billions of dollars each year. We'll find out what can be done to keep teachers teaching. And then there have been some complaints about the cooler, rainier summer we've been having. But it turns out that's been good for our Great Lakes. We find out why later in the hour. But first, it is Thursday, and that means it's time for our weekly check-in with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. And today, he's got his eye fixed on the storm clouds gathering for the Detroit Institute of Arts. This particular growing cloud comes from the north, from Oakland County. Daniel, before we get into that, set the stage for us. It was only a year ago that voters in Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb counties said yes to something very important to the DIA. Fill us in again.
They said yes to a millage increase on their property taxes that would be funneled through three separate arts authorities created in each of the three counties that would go to the DIA only. And one of the concerns was that any tax money from Macomb, Oakland, and Wayne would not be funneled into the general operations of the city of Detroit or to pay off debt. Well, we fast forward a year, and there's been real concern in these counties that somehow their tax money would in fact go to retiring debt for the city of Detroit, now in bankruptcy. And this week, County Executive Brooks Patterson and the Arts Authority in Oakland County said that if any piece of art is sold to satisfy debt, or at least in some lease arrangement or lease buyback type of thing, that their $9.8 million, which is an annual estimate, to the DIA would stop flowing. And I think it's very safe to say that the same thing would happen in Macomb and Wayne. I do know that there's been a meeting this week between the DIA officials in Macomb County to discuss this issue.
Mm. And how much are we talking about, Daniel, for an annual chip-in for those three counties?
About $22 million. Now, that's estimated based on current millages, and if property values continue to increase over time, that number could go a little higher because it's a percentage of the property value.
So what do you hear from DIA officials? This kind of feels like the warning shot across the bow from Brooks Patterson and the Oakland County Arts Authority.
Well, it is the warning shot, but I think it's also a help. You know, if you look at the bankruptcy and you've listened to chatter all around the state, a lot of people say, what do I care about the bankruptcy of the city of Detroit? It doesn't affect me. And I think this is very real to people in the three county area, because they now have a vested interest in the museum, and they're kind of acting like it. So in a sense, you have some people that are kind of throwing their weight implicitly, I think, behind the DIA, and it's bipartisan weight. You have Brooks Patterson, one of the most prominent Republicans in the state, and certainly Mark Hackle, an up-and-comer in the Democratic Party, and good old Democratic Wayne County, per usual. But nevertheless, I think you have a situation here that changes the dynamic a little bit. But I think that they're very concerned at the DIA that if they are forced by the emergency manager through bankruptcy to do anything that appears to be shoveling money out, pushing money outside the walls of the DIA, that this flow of cash will stop and they will be unable to fill the gap through fundraising in a very difficult and uncertain environment.
In fact, you quote DIA's Chief Operating Officer Anne Marie Erickson using the term death spiral.
Yeah, she and I have been having that conversation for several months now, I think at least going back to Mackinac in May, if not earlier. This has been a real concern of theirs because they realize the political fragility of this whole situation with the counties. And they're trying to impress it upon Kevin Orr and the people around him. And, well, you know, as we all know, both Kevin Orr and the governor have said there's no plans to sell the art, but they always qualify it at this time. All this being said, they are obligated to value all of the assets that the city holds, and that includes the DIA and its holdings.
So that's what this whole Christie's appraisal is about.
Exactly. But it's it, the kind of the unfortunate thing about all this is that the asset that everybody continually talks about is the DIA and about Bruegel the Elder's wedding dance and Diego Rivera's murals of the Detroit industry, which were donated by Edsel Ford. They weren't purchased by the city, but they are owned by the museum. Therefore, I think it potentially could be at risk. And the Van Gogh, I mean, that's what everybody talks about. They don't talk about the Joe Louis Fist downtown or the Spirit of Detroit or Belle Isle so much or the vintage cars that are packed away under plastic bubble wrap, all of which are city assets. So, I mean, there's a whole lot of things potentially at play here. But I think the DIA is a singular asset that could not be replicated today. And I think that's what people need to understand.
We're talking, as we do every Thursday, with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes, looking at the threats against the DIA. And now that Oakland County's Arts Authority has said the sale or lease of a single piece of cash would imperil almost $10 million in annual taxpayer funding from Oakland County. And as Daniel points out in his column today in the Detroit News, you could count on Wayne and McComb to follow suit quickly. And you talk in your piece, Daniel, about the differences between this dilemma the DIA faces and what was happening just a very few short years ago as the Detroit Symphony was on death's doorstep. Talk to us about the differences.
Well, I use it as an analogy kind of deliberately. You know, if you had a symphony that disappeared because of bankruptcy or difficult conditions, or let's say it was owned by the city and you got rid of it. Once you get back up on your feet 5 years from now or 3 years from now, you could marshal some money and go out and hire a hot young conductor and recruit some musicians and give them an opportunity to come and play in a symphony hall here, and you could restart the whole thing. You couldn't do that. Once you sell Bruegel's Wedding Dance, which was painted in the 1500s and was bought by the city in the 1920s, so they've had it, you know, 90 years, or the Van Gogh, which was painted, I think, in 1887, you can't get these things back. The Detroit Institute of Arts was created at a time, a golden age of Detroit, when the wealth that was being generated through industry in this community was enormous. And it's no accident that you go to like cities like Cleveland and Boston and New York. The finest museums in the country are in the northeast quadrant of the United States. They're not in the newer parts of the country. And there have been efforts to try and recreate these kinds and create these kinds of museums, and they really haven't been successful. The question is why? Why? Because the art's not available. And as soon as the first story broke about the DIA, people both at the emergency manager's office and at the DIA were fielding calls from sheiks in the Gulf, from Russian oligarchs, from people all over the world with more money than God, saying, is that stuff really for sale?
Because I'd love it in my collection.
I'd love it, and I'd like to put it in my house, and no one will ever see it again. And I think I understand what the arguments that people are making about the assets, but I think people have to recognize that this is really part of the heritage of this community.
But we still have to say you've got you know, retired firefighters who are worried that the pensions are going to be cut at a point when they will never be able to make that up again. You've got, you know, they feel they're being hung out to dry. You have creditors who feel they're being hung out to dry. Can art and talk of the cultural jewel really stand against that?
Well, and that's the problem. I mean, you know, I think that's what makes this so difficult. I mean, if you're a firefighter or a police officer who is either in retirement or nearing retirement and sees the prospect of having your pension cut by, I don't know, 30-40%, you look at this and you're not going to be very sympathetic. And that's a very real concern. The question is, are there other places to be, are there other assets that could potentially be liquidated? I think the problem for the DIA is that you know, it's kind of the old line about why do you rob a bank? It's because where the money is. There's a lot of value potentially that sunk into the DIA, so that makes it it puts it in the spotlight in a way that's very uncomfortable for the people involved and for its benefactors. But it is what it is, and efforts to shield the collection have been unsuccessful, and now would be too late. So, you know, we'll see what happens and whether they're actually going to do that. But this story is going to be alive for some time. This aspect of the story, I think. And I think we can bet on the fact that creditors are going to use the eligibility hearing in October before Judge Rhodes, and probably the confirmation plan of adjustment hearing in March to make this point and to say, look, they've got more value here than they are offering us, and they're not making it part of the package.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House, his piece in today's Detroit News, DIA Tax, Detroit's Heritage at Stake. As always, good to talk with you every Thursday, Daniel. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
And in other news, a federal appeals court has sided with the FBI in a Detroit lawsuit over access to records involving the use of race and ethnicity in investigations. The FBI will not give up the information to the American Civil Liberties Union, saying it might harm ongoing probes. The ACLU is concerned the FBI could be targeting certain ethnic groups and violating civil rights through racial profiling. In a 3-0 decision, an appeals court says the FBI properly invoked an exception in federal law when it denied certain records. The court says some data could alert criminals and terrorists as to how the FBI uses demographic information. The ACLU's Michigan chapter sued in 2011 after getting redacted pages and denials from the FBI. Still to come, yes, it has been a somewhat cooler, wetter summer here in Michigan, although not today. Today does feel like summer, but we'll find out why this is good news for our Great Lakes. That's in 20 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Wayne County officials say they soon hope to close a deal with a developer to buy a former car plant, the Packard Plant, a crumbling 35-acre site on Detroit's east side. It's become an iconic image that to many represents industrial decay and the decline of once proud Detroit. The Detroit News and Detroit Free Press both report the deal between the county and Evanston, Illinois-based developer Bill Hultz is tentatively set to close next week. Hultz wants to convert the 110-year-old facility into a commercial, housing, and entertainment complex. Many hurdles remain for Hultz, who hasn't disclosed his partners, nor has he completed a project of this size. Hultz plans to buy the plant for its $1 million in unpaid taxes. If the deal fails, the complex would be put into a public auction in September and sold off in parcels. So let's talk about what the future might hold for the Packard plant, because lessons learned with this 35-acre site could be applied to decaying urban buildings around Michigan and indeed the Midwest. For this conversation, we first welcome Anya Sirota, who's an assistant professor of architecture at the University of Michigan. She joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Joins us in the studio. Thank you.
Thank you.
And from Wayne State University, we welcome Robin Boyle, professor and chair of the Department of Urban Studies and Planning. Hello, Robin.
Hi there. Good to talk with you again.
Very good to have you with us on the program. Anya, let me start with you. What do you see as the historic and architectural significance of the Packard plant?
Well, the Packard plant is an extraordinary building. I'm not sure that it's unique architecturally or historically. It's an Albert Kahn building, but there were lots of Albert Kahn buildings being built at that time in Detroit and in this region. It's very large. It's reinforced concrete, the first reinforced concrete in Detroit, industrial complex. But again, there were lots of reinforced concrete buildings that were coming up in this region at about the same time. I think what makes this building, this complex, and this site so unique is the amount of time that it's been in neglect, the amount of time it's been in disuse. And so the kind of iconographic image that it's produced since it's been out of use for over 50 years, it's gotten a lot of people's imaginations going when it comes to its image.
And Robin, as Anya pointed out, this Packard plant hasn't produced a vehicle since the mid-1950s, and there were a few tenants. They've bailed out by the end of the 1990s. So From your thoughts, is this a structure, first, that should be saved, and secondly, can be saved?
No and no. I think another element of this discussion should be the fact that it has been a building that has been in and out of foreclosure. In other words, it's a building that has been part and parcel of the public domain to some extent for over 20 years. And irrespective of what happens through the market or those who have held businesses there, the public sector has failed, in my opinion, to deal with what has become a dreadful, iconic image of a failed place. And in my opinion, this building is well beyond any form of savior and should, in fact, be demolished.
Anya, you've actually led a course for Master of Science in Conservation students, and you focused on the creative reuse and restoration of the Packard plant.
I appreciate what Robin is saying about how difficult or maybe impossible it would be to preserve a building in this state of decay. But I think that it's important to reconsider the possibility of saving it, not in terms of preservation, but maybe in terms of conservation.
And now, tell me the difference.
So if preservation is bringing the building back to its earlier esteem or to an idealized moment in history, I agree with Robin. That's not very plausible.
That time has passed.
That time has passed. It's in really bad shape, certainly. And it's highly deconstructed and it's been highly neglected. Now, if we consider it as a conservation project, that means rethinking about its healthy longevity through alternate uses, maybe through the reuse of this site as a landscape, maybe through a fragmented reconstruction of a portion of the building. But we need to be very creative before we decide to completely demolish and obliterate some of the history and iconicity of Detroit's feral brand.
I can understand the concept, and indeed, around the world, there are many wonderful examples of how facilities that were important in the past have been retained and illustrate to folks today how these places existed, whether it was steel, coal, textile, shipbuilding. I mean, these areas have been preserved and have been in part used today to illustrate what was once the important economic development engines of these regions and cities. I would argue, however, that this building is beyond anything like that. There are, and I think this again illustrates the failure of us to actually identify which buildings that make up this rich history of the automobile industry that we could collectively work together to show, to demonstrate, to illustrate. We have many properties that could do that. I think glamming onto the Packard plant is to take our eye, to take our focus away from what is really possible in some wonderful facilities that are well located, that could be visited by many people in a variety of different ways. On my opinion, this 3.5 million square feet of rotting building that is toxic in a whole variety of ways should be removed and should be the responsibility of all of us to clear it up. I mean, I do understand the value of the past in showing it. I just don't think this building should be part of that.
So the question for me is the narrative of this past. If we're indeed trying to show the glamour of Detroit's auto industry, maybe the Packard isn't the place for us to look. Maybe that's not the place for us to preserve. I certainly think that the Packard is an unsolicited monument to capital extraction. It's an unsolicited monument to some of Detroit's failures, if you will. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if we start to look at, say, social media and the way the image of the Packard has been disseminated
around the world.
Around the world.
That term ruin porn, which I know makes a lot of people's flesh crawl, but it certainly has become one of the key images of ruin porn.
But it's a very, very powerful image that's understood nationally and internationally and has feral power. It has a kind of power of image making and dissemination. When you look at how many times those images are disseminated through social media, then the Packard plant starts to look just about as good as, say, Guggenheim's Bilbao. It gets just as many hits. So we need to be very sensitive about which buildings in Detroit are able to produce that kind of excitement and iconicity and think very carefully about how we're going to manage them before we obliterate the very image that gives Detroit its power.
I do think I hear you both saying kind of you have the same desire. Let's put our efforts into the structures that most warrant this. Can I throw a couple out for ideas? The Michigan Central Building, which when I think of ruined buildings in Detroit, comes to my mind. I've watched it from the time they closed it in 1988. Is that something, is that an example, Robin, of a building that you feel could be worth the effort?
I don't wish to disagree, but I'm of a very different opinion about these two particular buildings. I actually think these are part of our challenge, and it makes us even harder to get past the past. These two particular sites, in my opinion, need to be addressed by us, the collective, the public sector, and removed for a whole variety of reasons. I think they get in the way of this place moving forward, moving into a different world, and they represent something that we've struggled with for the best part of a generation.
Struggled with and failed. Right to address.
Failed. These are iconic examples of failure, and I think we've plenty of really good places that can capture what this place has to show to demonstrate the importance of the automobile and other activities in the Midwest.
What might be some examples to give us an idea of what you're referring to, Robin? What might be some structures that you would feel would be worth preserving and saving?
Woodward Avenue, Highland Park, the home of the automobile, has got not only a plant that exists and is standing up, but the buildings, the offices, even the archives are right there on Woodward Avenue to be visited, to be shown, to be part and parcel of understanding the history of Detroit. Dodge Main disappeared. The Packard plant can disappear. The legacy of the automobile industry will continue. Let's make good choices and let's do it right.
I agree with Robin that it's not going to be possible to manage these sites at their scale and in their condition without interest from the public sector, without direct involvement from public-private partnerships and institutional interests. But at the same time, I don't agree with Robin about needing to mitigate an idealized historical moment that tells the perfected history of Detroit. I think that looking at the entire landscape of that city, at its failures, at its successes, and thinking about a coherent overall idea about how to produce a contemporary city is important as well. And there's nothing shameful about Detroit's failures, and that doesn't mean that those failures need to remain as insecure, blighted sites in the contemporary moment. They can be rethunk in a completely new, contemporary way, mixing new ideals.
If you just join us, that was Anya Sirota, who is an assistant professor of architecture at the University of Michigan. And she is joined from Detroit, from Wayne State University, by Robin Boyle, who's professor and chair of the Department of Urban Studies and Planning, as we talk about the Packard plant. Because right now there is a possible deal with a developer to buy that crumbling 35-acre site on Detroit's east side. I was wondering, as this story is really making some major headlines today, what do you both think of this proposal from developer William Hultz of Evanston? He's talking about housing and restaurants and offices and shopping and a hotel. I guess if I ask, is this feasible, Robin, I think your answer would be you don't think so.
You're dead right on that one. There is nothing in what I've read that gives me any hope that this changes the dynamic of that piece of property. Not a thing.
It's an interesting proposal, and I'm just as dubious about the possibility of this coming to fruition as Robin. To rehab a building in this state of neglect in order for it to house such standard programs would be a huge commercial challenge. I think it would be much, much easier to produce a complex of this scale using new materials rather than attempting to reconstruct the remnants of what's on that site. But the idea that this particular developer is interested in gaining visibility and notoriety for his project by deploying the Packard as a site of his installation speaks to the power of some of these buildings in Detroit that still have this potential to garner so much visibility and excitement.
So with that kind of out of the way, the idea of housing and restaurants and offices and a hotel, let me start with you, Robin. What do you think should be done with that site?
I think it should be cleared, and I think it should be the responsibility of the government to do that, to take it under their wing and clear this particular site entirely. It doesn't need to be done in 1 year. It would take a while. But I think that this is an example. And, you know, we've been here for 20 years since it's been in and out of foreclosure with the government in Southeast Michigan. Time is now to clear this site and look for other options.
Such as?
And nothing. Maybe seriously.
Seriously, nothing.
Nothing. Oh. Nothing. It doesn't need this. We don't need it in that area. It might be connected to an industrial area over there if the market begins to turn around. But there are lots of other areas, lots of other great buildings that can be brought back to life, lots of other parts of the city that can be reflective of the past and looking to the future, the whole riverfront area, the whole the park structure that we have here already, the downtown, some of the great neighborhood buildings that we have, some of the schools which should remain and not be knocked down that are a tremendous legacy of what Detroit was in the past. Let's get rid of the Packard plant now.
And Anya?
What's really ironic about the project of demolishing the Packard is that scrapping, which is what made the Packard come so undone in the last 20 to 30 years, is the same activity that has preserved the building, meaning that scrappers have taken the material that could have been recycled away from the building and made demolition much more expensive because the cost of demolition can't be offset through the recuperation of its metal. And so the only metal that's left on site is what's embedded in the concrete, and that can't be scrapped anymore. And so in this condition, the idea that it would be demolished, that someone would pick up the tab, whether it's $20 million or higher, that's kind of a pipe dream. So I think Detroit's responsibility now and our collective responsibility is to think about what to do with this site, given that demolition is improbable and that the reappropriation and the recuperation of this site for regular commercial use is also equally improbable. So I'm hoping that we're not going to wait another 50 years for this site to just continue to deconstruct itself, but we're going to be able to think of a way to secure it and render it a usable landscape.
In what way? Give me a sense of when you talk about a usable landscape, what would that look like?
I think that some of the projects that we've been looking at as a collective at the University of Michigan are projects that come from European community scenarios where there are equally large industrial complexes with very, very complicated histories and the impossibility of demolition. And looking at recuperating just a fragment of that site and securing the rest of it for a usable landscape. So admitting that we're not going to be able to reprogram 35 million square feet of property in the middle of this area. It's just not feasible. But maybe we could begin to insert small portions of public programming and cultural programming and then secure the rest of the site so it's not a frightening area for residents in that area.
It certainly strikes me that this building and the conversation that we've just enjoyed with both of you really sum up the kinds of challenges that lie ahead for your students, for tomorrow's architects and tomorrow's urban planners as they look at America's big cities. And it's complex and it's challenging. And as I say, it's really your students who are going to make the difference, isn't it?
Yeah, they've got a huge responsibility and a huge challenge, which is why I think that working in Detroit on questions of conservation rather than preservation, it's an exceptionally exciting field to be in.
Robin, last word for you.
Absolutely. I mean, I think these are the challenges that our students will face in the future. But I do think that they need to see it in a bigger picture. And as Anya said, programs around the world have demonstrated how government can take the role of changing the way and places that we live in. They need to be able to see that and not realize that it's just going to be sitting aside and watching what happens to space, buildings, and community. We need to be more proactive. We need to be engaged and addressing the challenges such as the Packard plant or other such places in the city of Detroit. This is a big challenge, but I think we can provide them with the tools, the understanding to make a difference.
That was Robin Boyle, professor and chair of the Department of Urban Studies and Planning at Wayne State University in Detroit. And he was joined by Anya Sirota, who was here in the studio, assistant professor of architecture at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you. Such a pleasure.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Still to come, data shows that teachers dropping out of their profession cost the nation around $7 billion a year. Coming up on Stateside, we talk with a researcher who's been trying to keep teachers in their jobs. She heads a program that could serve as a national model. That story in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. There has been a healthy degree of grumbling and grousing this year by lovers of hot weather. We had a cool and rainy spring, and certainly this summer has not been a replay of last year's very hot, very dry season. But here's something to think about. The cooler, wetter weather is good medicine for our Great Lakes and those all-important water levels. Let's find out why as we welcome MLive meteorologist Mark Torregrossa. Hi, Mark.
Hey, good day. How are you doing there?
Doing well, doing well. With this cooler, wetter weather, I'm just hearing people that I know that have boats, they're grumpy. It hasn't made them very happy. But why is this weather good news for the Great Lakes and Lake St. Clair?
Well, the Great Lakes levels are coming up, and when you have cooler weather, you have less evaporation. And the cooler weather is actually a byproduct of the wet pattern that we've been in. Now, the summer, we've had some dry weather here in the summer, if you talk to farmers, but in general, we've had quite a bit of precipitation in the last year, and especially to the north, Lake Superior and the drainage basin around Lake Superior in the last month has had about 160% of its normal precipitation. That runs into Lake Superior, and then eventually that makes it into Lake Michigan and Lake Huron, bringing the lake levels up.
So essentially, Superior is kind of sharing the excess with Michigan and Huron.
Yeah, so what it is, it's actually regulated by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and Environment Canada. And what they did August 1st is they said Lake Superior has gone up sufficiently enough that we can open the gates on the Sioux Locks more and bring more water into Lake Michigan and Lake Huron. And that's something we haven't had in a while. So Lake Superior is sending more water to Lake Michigan and Lake Huron.
And what are we seeing in Ontario, Erie, and St. Clair?
Well, they've been interesting because they've been actually not too low in general over the last several years. And so, for example, Ontario is actually above its long-term water level average. So if you go to Lake Ontario, you don't hear people talking about low water levels. Erie's about the same, not too low or just slightly below normal. And then the low water levels really have been on what we call the upper lakes here on Michigan Superior. And now it's centered basically on Lake Michigan and Huron, but improving somewhat. Give you an example.
Uh-huh.
Lake Superior is 5 inches below its long-term average. Lake Michigan, Lake Huron is 18 inches below its long-term average.
So it could use that extra dose of help from Superior.
It definitely could. And what the Army Corps of Engineers told me was if you took everything else out of the equation, that extra water that Lake Superior is sending down into Michigan and Huron would be about 1 inch of water per month.
Hmm.
That's a lot of water.
Hmm.
800 billion gallons.
Now, the payoff from those higher water levels is?
Well, just, I guess, increased recreational boating, more enjoyable living. Folks that have cottages that used to have nice access to the shore and now they're walking through muck to their boat. Some shipping access, too. Now, we do still have a long ways to go.
Mm-hmm.
My thought is, you know, if Michigan and Huron went up another 6 inches to a foot, there would really be no low water level issue for folks with cabins. So it's still an issue, but if we continue to trend that way, if we continue to, unfortunately, for some, stay colder than normal and wetter than normal in the fall, and then we get a cold, snowy winter, and then we get a cold, wet spring, we could certainly add that 6 to 12 inches into Lake Michigan Huron in a big hurry.
Well, now you say if. Do you have any sense from the long-range forecasts how likely we might get to get this cool, wet fall and the snowy winter and the rainy spring?
Well, right now we're heading the opposite way. We're heading warm and dry for the fall, and it looks like that may hold. But I still see the super cold pocket of air up in Canada that kind of started last November and finally moved down into our area in February. It's up there. If that continues to build, it may be the sign of another cold, snowy winter. It's too early to tell on that just yet, but I see the point source. I see the cold pocket up there that if it happened, I wouldn't be surprised.
So if you have to get that snow shovel out next February, don't grumble too much because, as you say, it's good medicine for the Great Lakes.
Exactly.
Mark Torregrossa, the meteorologist with MLive, and he also runs farmerweather.com, a site dedicated to weather information for farmers and agriculture. Always good to talk with you, Mark. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So here we are. We have moved into the last half of August. Parents are taking the kids on back-to-school shopping trips. And from parent to parent, there's conversation and buzz and speculation about who's going to be teaching little Johnny, which teachers will still be there, who'll be gone when the kids return from summer vacation. When teachers leave a school, it hits students hard. A researcher from the University of Michigan and his colleagues studied data over an 8-year period and found teacher turnover harms student learning, especially in math and English. And it's not just the kids who have to cope with a new teacher who suffer. Students of teachers who remain in the same grade and the same school from one year to the next are also harmed by teacher turnover. And then there's the dollars and cents view. A study by the National Commission on Teaching and America's Future estimates that teachers dropping out of the profession cost the nation, get ready for this, about $7 billion a year. Trying to stem teacher turnover and keep teachers in the classroom and in the profession. That's the mission of my next guest. Randy Stanulis is an associate professor of education at Michigan State University, and she directs a teacher mentoring program that some say could ultimately serve as a national model. Randy Stanulis joins us now from East Lansing. Hi, Randy.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Well, research has found, and I couldn't believe this when I read this, nearly 50% of new teachers leave within 5 years.
Right. And those statistics are primarily for urban areas where we really need to have excellent teachers who provide a stable workforce for the kids and for the communities. But yes, those are the numbers.
And just to be clear, are they leaving a specific school and district, or are they bailing out of the teaching profession altogether?
I know that there's differing statistics for both of those questions. Those are really good ones. I do know that from just anecdotally from my own students who have participated in our induction program, that unfortunately many of them leave the profession because they just feel that they're left alone to teach and they feel unsupported and they feel like they had such ideals for how they were going to make a difference and those were so unfulfilled that they leave the profession. Now, there are other cases, a district where I worked that I won't name. It's not in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
It's a large district where some of the district's population was in very high poverty schools, and that's where primarily new teachers were placed. But then as soon as they have 1 or 2 years of experience, they then fly as fast as they can to the suburban schools, which then have much smaller amounts of percentages of teacher turnover. So the half of their district is always having that revolving door, always having
wow.
new teachers. So I think there's some cases that people tend to fly from urban to suburban, and there are some cases where they leave the profession altogether. And then there are some there are some programs, University of Michigan and Michigan State, have really made it a mission to focus on preparing teachers who want to stay in urban schools. So I think that's one way that we're trying through teacher preparation to make make a difference in teacher turnover as well.
You know, it strikes me as you talk about this high dropout rate from the profession of these new teachers, because seriously, within 5 years, you're still a baby teacher,
exactly,
if you will. And it strikes me that medical students graduate and nobody expects a newly minted graduate medical student to start operating on patients the next week. You have
exactly
to look at a 5 to 7 year residency training program before that happens. So, but aren't we doing that to these newly minted teachers?
You know, I have said that exact line in many speeches across the country, that there's no other profession that just has a sink or swim mentality like teaching. Yeah, so that's why I think some places are moving to more of a residency model. Like I know one of my former doctoral students is now working with the Boston Teacher Residency, where they specifically work with the students to have a really intensive lab-based experience where the teachers who are mentoring them have very intensive professional development, where the instructors are serving in a clinical role where they're always in the schools, and so that first year that they're teaching is much more scaffolded than any of us do, you know, in the country.
I'm speaking with Randy Stanulis, who's an associate professor of education at Michigan State University, and she directs a teacher mentoring program that's called Launch Into Teaching. And some are saying that this program could ultimately serve as a national model. Now, let's focus in here on Michigan. We know there's legislation that requires new teachers to be supervised by a mentor teacher for the first 3 years of their career. But what's missing, in your view, from this state plan?
Yes, I was actually involved with some of the wonderful people from NDE who helped to craft that legislation. And I was part also with Barbara Markle from Michigan State. We led this initiative called Assist Beginning Teachers, which is still alive as a website. If you Google Assist Beginning Teachers, it's a resource for Michigan mentors and principals and new teachers to provide some support. Because what's missing from legislation is that it really only requires teachers to be assigned a mentor, and it neglects the fundamental principles of the selection of people who can be exemplary mentors and the preparation of people that can be to be exemplary mentors, and also the role that school leaders play in promoting beginning teacher learning, understanding beginning teacher learning, and really having a role in creating a whole school culture that creates a more stable teaching force.
And there's no dedicated funding, is there?
There is no dedicated funding. Exactly, exactly. That is, of course, a primary problem.
And so what I think I'm hearing is, well, yeah, there's a mentoring program, but it's in name only in many cases. And
right,
so the right people aren't being picked to be mentors, nor are they given the support or the funding to really do the job.
Exactly. And that's not a problem only in Michigan. I think that's pretty pervasive across the country, that people will say, oh, yes, I have a mentor. I'm teaching second grade, and my mentor is the art teacher in the other building, or, you know, or I have a mentor, yes, but she's been in to see me twice the whole year, or something like that. That's the more typical problem, and that's why a lot of people dismiss mentoring as a function of really helping someone learn. And our program works at selection and very intensive professional development that's sustained for mentors over 2 to 3 years, so they can understand the learning needs of beginning teachers. And also, we work very closely with the principals, because I think that's the other missing piece, that if I know instructional leaders or principals feel like their role, they have so many different things to do in their role, but
yeah,
that instructional leadership part is the part that makes the school thrive and is often neglected.
You've been running Launch Into Teaching in the Lansing School District. How long have you been doing that?
We were in Lansing from 2005 to, I think, 2009. At that time, toward the end, they had very few beginning teachers, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
What did
yeah
the data show you as far as is the effectiveness of your program?
We have conducted several studies in different sites around the country in different districts where we've been, and in every case we have engaged in pre and post observation. So we've observed a control group of teachers who are not in our program, as well as our teachers who are receiving the induction treatment at the beginning and the end of 1 year, and in all cases we've always shown that there's been a pretty dramatic difference between our teachers and the other teachers in the district, because we target one element of effective teaching, which is discussion-based teaching, and that's a teaching practice that's associated with exemplary teachers, and it's often a practice that beginning teachers are introduced to during their teacher preparation program and then feel that they have absolutely no time or support or energy to try to do during their beginning years. And that's a lot of the reason that I think that instruction suffers for beginning teachers in their early years. So we have them doing something pretty ambitious in their first year, supported by a mentor. And then, you know, principals in Atlanta where we worked before would say to the superintendent, the beginning teachers in this project outperformed the veterans in the state test.
Wow. That tells you that's some pretty good data to support what you're doing. Take us deep into the actual workings of the program in a school. How are mentors chosen and matched and trained and, most importantly, supported in a way that's better than what we see in our state now?
Well, it happens differently in different districts. The main criteria that I'd say, and this is, I know, anyone who's done this work will know this is the hardest, is that it has to have the support of central administration, the superintendent. And that's actually another thing that happened in Lansing. Sharon Banks, who was superintendent at the time, helped actually, she was a major player in developing the induction program with me. She was a partner, and we led the program together. And then when she left, it wasn't the priority of the next superintendent.
Mm.
The same thing happened in Atlanta. So I think that that without that central district support, then it's much more complicated, because especially because all I do is work in urban districts, when the districts are so large, for them to think about a unified vision for how they want to approach induction, it can't really be building by building. Although in Detroit now I'm working in 28 charter schools where it really is building by building, and so I have to work much more intensively with individual principals on helping them understand the rationale and the vision. Definitely having criteria and having conversations about how important selection is definitely the first step.
And then matching the right mentor with the young teacher. What do you do
there?
Well,
that's the other thing that when I found when I started and I looked at the data across the country, really, that one of the things that we were finding was that people were not matched by grade level or content area, or sometimes even proximity in the building or proximity, they weren't even in the same building sometimes. Mm-hmm. So when we started working in Lansing, we changed the structure so that it was really that people were matched by either elementary or by content area, because they had not been in that way in the past, so that they could really work on content-specific teaching.
Overall, Randy, what are your hopes for launch into teaching?
My biggest hope is to make a difference in the stability of the teaching force in urban schools, so we can see the fruits of the efforts that we start over the years sustain, because that's my greatest worry is, like I'm sure you know, in so many education reforms, we start something, you start to see a change, and then people stop investing in it, and they move on to the next reform. Mm. And I think teacher induction is something that needs a more sustained investment if you're going to really see the fruits of the rehab as the teachers develop. Like you said before, most people leave before 5 years. Well, if we can keep those people there for 10 years and they have this kind of support from the very beginning of their teaching career to be really effective teachers, then just think what a great difference they could make, and they could become leaders in their districts. So to me, I guess my greatest hope is that it's given the opportunity to sustain itself long enough.
Randy Stanulis is an associate professor of education at Michigan State University. She directs this induction teacher mentoring program called Launch Into Teaching. Some say it could ultimately serve as a national model. Randy spoke to us today from East Lansing. Thanks for your time and talking with us today on the program, Randy.
Thank you very much.
We've been hearing from lots of you, some great story ideas, great comments on segments you've heard on Stateside. We love hearing from you. You can find us online at michiganradio.org at the Stateside link. On Facebook, search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. So get in touch, offer up your comments. We do love to hear from you. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Skahn. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, and April Van Buren. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock.